Clear the decks for the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. The Medicare podcast that rolls snake eyes every time. As an ATO pledge, he was lower than whale poop at the bottom of the Marianas Trench. It's Medicare expert Doug Jones.
Well, yes, I am Doug Jones. Thank you very much, Drew McMillan, for that magnificent introduction. And thank you, audience, for showing your appreciation. As you can see, I'm blushing. And it's awfully nice to have you here. But next time, wear deodorant, will you? There isn't enough fresh air blowing into this. Hello, it is the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. We're recording this on April 21st. And it's episode 44. Hard to believe we've done this 44 times, actually 46 times. We had a few special ones. I'm so happy to have the audience with us today. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to this podcast. We know it's not your first choice, maybe, to learn about Medicare, but we try to make it palatable and maybe entertaining. At least you get to hear us goofing around. Wanted to know what a Medicare expert thinks and talks about. By listening to Randy and I talk, you'll understand that the free association flows and drags us away from the subject matter frequently. Drew McMillan is our announcer, and he has been faithfully announcing every episode of this podcast ever since it began way back in the dark ages. He is my nephew and one of my favorite sister's oldest sons. He is also the host of a television show in Canada called Powerboat TV. I've watched almost the whole season, 2020 season. I think I'm still missing the last episode of the season, but I watch it on powerboattv.com, and it has all the episodes. So if you want to see what Drew McMillan looks like and watch him express his weird sense of humor sometimes and his sincere interest in all things boating, then powerboattv.com is the place to go. Again, this is the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. Who's the lazy man? It is a man or a woman. If there's a third sex, I don't know what it would be, but men and women eventually get to the point in their lives where they have to face Medicare. They have to think about the Medicare decisions that they need to make, and often it's difficult to find reliable sources of information. We are that reliable source of information for the people who don't have any other source of information. So the lazy man is any man or woman who doesn't really want to learn about Medicare, but is looking for the minimum necessary information to make proper decisions. They can find that in my book, Medicare for the Lazy Man 2020. Often they can find gems of wisdom here in this podcast, Medicare for the Lazy Man. And they can go to our website, medicareforthelazyman.com. In any event, the creator of that website and my socially distant broadcast engineer, Randy Carson, is here with us today. Hi, Randy.
Doug, how are you doing up there on the pinnacle peak of Cave Creek?
I think I'm just terrific looking down on all the little people and, pinching their heads with my fingers, and that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely. Given the fact that you live on a mountain up there around Cave Creek, it always reminds me of Edinburgh in Scotland, because in order to get to the castle in Edinburgh, you walk up about a mile street that's virtually 30 degrees up. And, so in case you can't make it, you fall down and you roll down about a half a mile. But the castle is clear up on the top of a very, very tall mountain.
I'm guessing it was built with the idea of tiring out your enemies should they ever come to visit.
Yes, it was. I think it's actually called the Golden Mile, but in Chicago, isn't there the Miracle Mile?
There is the Miracle Mile, and the reason that's miraculous is because some guy in the 1800s had a boat. I can't remember if it was like he just hauled goods around the Great Lakes or whatever, but he eventually got it grounded offshore in a storm or something, or ran aground. I think he might have been drunk. He's not a well thought of kind of guy, the land eventually silted in around his boat and formed a whole big chunk of downtown, which is now a really, really high rent district. The Miracle Mile and the Gold Coast and all of that is due to some guy, Streeter, I think. You hear the name Streeterville as applied to a neighborhood in Chicago. But it's all because this guy couldn't keep his boat afloat. And I think his heirs came back later and tried to claim ownership of that part of downtown Chicago with skyscrapers on it and everything.
I was going to say, how'd that go over?
Yeah, well, when you've got a Democrat machine in charge of your town, nothing's going to happen without the boss rubber stamping it, and the boss wasn't ready to rubber stamp that expenditure.
Yeah, I have to say that always the same thing everybody says about Chicago, right, and politics.
And what's that?
Vote early and vote often.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And go to the cemetery and, you know, you'll get some new registrants on the voter rolls. But I grew up in Republican territory, 35-40 miles west of Chicago. And so it was a totally different environment, suburban, not urban. But I had in my show notes, as you might have, or my podcast episode checklist, as we call it, I had a notation to myself. I left a hanging chad the last time we got together.
I hate those hanging chads.
Yes. Well, we can count them, though. We can just
but they
count
only
them
count
all
in Florida, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Hanging chads only count in Florida.
They only count in Florida, and you have to stop counting when the Supreme Court says you've done enough. Anyway, so I made a notation to myself to tell my Texas snake oil story. We were talking about snake oil. You mentioned snake oil specific.
Yes, yes.
You remember
snake
that?
Oil. I do remember that.
I've got a Texas snake oil story that relates to the house that my parents bought in St. Charles, Illinois, many, many years ago, back in the prior millennium. But that house was built by a woman who inherited pretty much all the money in the world back then. But how did that money get created? Well, back in the 18, a young guy was growing up in what is now West Chicago, Illinois, but it was back then Turner Junction. And this guy was trying to figure out what he was going to do for a living. He was ambitious, but opportunities didn't grow on trees. So he wound up in the hardware business and owned or rented a hardware store or ran a hardware. And I think that went broke, and then he had another hardware store. He wound up going to work for a guy named Glidden. Glidden in DeKalb and or Sycamore, Illinois. I don't know where the factory was. Glidden was the gentleman who invented barbed wire. And it might be the patent that's been the most stolen and copied and reproduced of any patentable item in American history. But he invented barbed wire. He probably invented also the method to manufacture it. And so he sent salesmen out all over the Midwest to sell barbed wire. And the advantage to barbed wire was that cattle would get poked and they would not push the fence. So if you put a fence up, if a farmer or a rancher put a fence up, the livestock would not destroy the fence, typically, because the barbs would poke the cattle or the pigs or whatever and dissuade them from destruction. Well, Texas ranchers never believed that their longhorns could ever be tamed or corralled by barbed wire. In addition to that, it seemed like an antisocial act in Texas to fence off the prairie anyway. They would still have their big cattle drives up north to the railhead or whenever the railroad came close, that would be where they would go, Hayes, Kansas or whatever. So Glidden sent this salesman whose name was John Gates down to Texas, where he was probably destined to fail. And he actually did just hit a brick wall. He was unable to persuade Texas ranchers. The product that he was selling, barbed wire, would effectively contain longhorn cattle. So having failed at that, he was sitting in a bar in San Antonio, along a main street in San Antonio, basically drinking his last few dollars in beer, I guess. And he looked out the window, and there was a guy on a medicine wagon, on the back of the wagon, giving a speech, and he had drawn quite a crowd. He was selling some kind of snake. He was quite the showman. This guy had drawn lots and lots of interested onlookers. Once he had the audience, you know, his whole thing was to get them to cough up some money, purchase his product. And this started the wheels turning in Mr. Gates's head. And so Gates took some mental notes and started thinking, and he probably had some more beer. He was sitting in the bar, but he said, okay, I have to have a way to demonstrate my product so that it will convince the potential customers the job. So what he did was he convinced he asked the town council of San Antonio for permission to build a corral in the middle of the widest street. And they said, sure. You know, and I think a lot of them were probably snickering. Then he went out to a couple of ranches and he collected the lamest, oldest, and most docile longhorn cattle that those ranchers had available. And he drove this herd into town, put them in this corral. Then he went around to all these cowboys that were preparing to stay up all night and watch the fun. He made a bunch of side bets that the cattle would still be there in the morning. He stayed up with them, apparently, and I believe there was a lot of carousing that night. In fact, there's a hotel very close to the Alamo with a plaque on the wall describing the scene. But what I'm telling you came from Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story and from the family, who many of whose members I'm friends with in Illinois. But anyway, John Gates, the following morning, had his herd inside the intact barbed wire corral that he was allowed to build in the middle of the main street. He went around and collected all the side bet money. And this is in the 1880s. It was, I think, like $100,000+ in equivalent U.S. currency back then. $5,000 in side bets was what I was told. And he took orders for 44 carloads of barbed wire that first day. The rest is history. He sold barbed wire faster than he could write the orders. The money came flowing in. Glidden's competitors were trying to steal that market, that very lucrative Texas market. John Gates probably was one of those people that tried to take over the barbed wire manufacturing because he bought some steel companies and consolidated them. And I believe they became the basis of U.S. Steel. But in any event, in 1901, he and a bunch of friends decided that it was time to get it in the awl business. And so they got together, formed a partnership, 10 guys, founded a company called The Texas Company. And the first lease where they actually had a gusher was on a little hilltop outside of Richardson, Texas, called Spindletop. Spindletop is still producing oil today. And if Texaco hadn't lost a huge lawsuit to Pennzoil about 20 years ago, they would be the largest retailer of oil and petroleum products in the world today, out back. But anyway, how is this tied into me? My parents bought the house. When John Gates died, which was premature, basically, he was predeceased by his son and his wife. And so he left the money to his niece, who was 13 years old at the time, and to his father-in-law. And those two wound up sharing the money, which was equivalent, I think, to $60 million then. And God knows what it would be now, upwards of hundreds and hundreds of millions. And eventually the father-in-law died, and the little girl wound up with all the money. Someday I'll tell you about her life, but basically she married her high school sweetheart, went on to have a very happy life, very wonderful woman, highly thought of, but she built a house that my parents wound up buying decades later after she had been dead for a few years. That's the house I'm trying to sell right now, but Illinois is sort of in the doldrums. That was my Texas snake oil story. He got the idea from a snake oil salesman and created an empire that included Texaco and barbed wire. So I don't know. How's that for free association? What does that have to do with Medicare, Randy?
I know what it's got to do with Medicare, because there's a lot of snake oil salesmen in Medicare, especially.
My God, leave it to you to draw that.
In the Medicare Advantage plans.
Yeah, you're right about that. We hated to see Joe Broadway Joe Namath join their ranks. We talked about that a while back too.
Yeah, so I'm just curious, around the concept of Medicare and P PDPs and all that good stuff. I've always wondered if you are on Medicare and you have a PDP, you know, it's kind of along the lines of the Broadway Joe sales. You know, they say, oh, have you got a drug discount plan? Oh yeah, well normally it would be $4,012,000, but for you, because you have this thing you cut out of Reader's Digest, it's $4. So tell us about that.
Wow. Well, drug discount card. Let's see, how far can we go from Texas Longhorns to drug discount cards? Well, if I understood your question correctly, you're saying, is it possible that you can get a drug discount card that's a good deal? And I don't know. I still don't know much about them because I've never explored them. They have given us a PDP, a prescription drug plan for people on Medicare, ease the cost of buying prescription medication. But still, some people swear by these discount cards, these drug discount cards. And without knowing much about them, I had to do some research. And I researched assiduously all afternoon until it was beer o'clock. And I came up with an article by a doctor, Richard Segal, MD. The article he wrote is headlined, Drug Discount Cards Lifting the Veil of Secrecy. So if I understood Randy's question properly, that would be, is it possible to have a drug discount card and do well with it or not? And can you have it with your PDP? And I think, yes, you can use a drug discount card anytime you want to, but will it do you any good? I don't know. So I have to fall back on this article by Dr. Segal. And he says, everywhere I look today, I see ads claiming huge savings from drug discount cards. He says, these cards promise huge savings to consumers, yet they are unable to deliver on these outrageous statements. Now when I see these ads, I'm skeptical, and you should be too, because not all the claims are, he says, they're too good to be true. If it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Drug discount cards have the potential of helping patients save a lot of money, but you have to understand, it's important to remember that they all work basically the same way. Here are the basics. First, a company called a pharmacy benefits manager, a PBM, or an adjudicator. Oh, good. Let's get complicated now. They set up a network of participating pharmacies. So they go knock on the doors, talk to the druggists or the owners of the pharmacies, and the pharmacies agree to accept the cards when a customer comes in to present them and buy a prescription or fill a prescription. And then the PBM negotiates with these pharmacies and works out discounts on the drugs they dispense. The discount is usually a percentage of the cash price of the drug, and the percentage may vary from drug to drug. Next, the PBM finds companies or organizations to which to market their card, meaning employees of large companies. They find them all in one place, and it's easier, less expensive to market to a larger group of people. So then they may also be using a multi-level marketing organization. And some marketers work with multiple groups. They can't make enough money selling one card, so they might sell several drug prescription cards. And then he goes on to say, the amount you pay for when using a drug card is the sum of four components. Now, I don't know how deeply we want to get into this, but basically there's a discount that's negotiated with the drugs. The pharmacy is also given a transaction fee. The PBM gets a transaction fee, and the marketer gets a transaction fee, which is basically a commission. Why pharmacies accept discount cards? Well, he's got a few reasons here. Earning a profit even at the discounted price. Their profits are slimmed down, but if they accept the cards, more people will come in to buy drugs there, so they can make it up on selling prescriptions they wouldn't sell otherwise. For example, if a customer may not be able to afford a prescription with a non-discounted price of $100, but may be able to afford it at a discounted price, the pharmacy gets the sale but earns a lower profit. They wouldn't have gotten the sale in the first place without the discount card. Building customer loyalty is another element of their incentive for you accepting the cards. Increased non-pharmaceutical purchases. Now, this makes sense. There's a reason why most pharmacies are at the back of the drugstore. This arrangement forces you to walk down aisles and maybe make impulse purchases. Also, peer pressure. If all the drugstores in town but yours accept these discount cards, then you're going to be the one that loses out because the people with the cards are going to accept the cards. So how do the marketers make money, the people that sell the cards? Well, there are transaction fees. There's the selling of information. In other words, if you want a drug discount card and you sign up and give a lot of personal information, that information gets resold, probably winds up in China and or Nigeria with some people who may use it in a nefarious manner, bother you constantly when it turns 65. Medicare, 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 Medicare. So here are some suggestions this Dr. Segal had. Never pay for a card. There are many good cards that are free. There is no reason to pay for a drug discount card because it's unlikely to be any better than a free one. Never register for a card. This is one way marketers get that info that they sell to others. Read the privacy policy. Oh, that sounds like fun. Don't just click, yes, I read and agree. Read it. Number four, helpline. All reputable marketers have a toll-free helpline. Give the line a call and see how responsive they are. Do they have real people answering your questions or just a recording? Number five, shop around. Try different cards to see which ones you like the best, which ones offer the best discount for the drugs you take. Obviously, it's not all people take the same drugs, and some cards may be more than others. And finally, consider who's making money. All things being equal, here's where the guy gets a little, he says, use a card offered by a nonprofit. Any money they make is going to further their cause, while the money earned by a for-profit is just going into someone's pocket. Well, I have no problems with for-profit companies because my pockets can hold money. So that's the description of drug cards. I had never known anything about them. Frankly, I'm pretty happy and satisfied with my current pharmacy plan that I don't see any reason to go shopping. How about you, Randy?
You know what that reminds me of? I'm just sitting here and you're, you know, explaining how these and the whole time I'm just sitting here going, Medicare Advantage plans, Medicare Advantage.
Yeah.
It sounds like the same sort of a deal, except for maybe it's not sold under an MLM model.
Well, actually, the drug cards are sold under MLM, whereas the Medicare Advantage plans are typically not MLM. But the other thing is that if you have a Medicare Advantage plan, most of those include drug coverage, but the cards then would be, you know, on the side. Now, the Medicare Advantage plans that include drug coverage, you don't have any say-so over what drug coverage is built into the plan. So it's possible that you get a Medicare Advantage plan at the beginning of a year that covers the drugs that you take and has your favorite doctors in the network. And then during the course of the year, they decide, well, we're going to change that so that we don't pay as much for this, but we pay more for that. So at the end of the year, you wind up basically with your drugs not covered nearly as well. You're paying more out of pocket. Your doctor decided to quit the network. And now you got to go shopping for a new plan at the end of the year. So it is not the land of milk and honey that the Medicare Advantage plan marketers would have you believe.
It is still the same story as it's been for our entire life, Doug. Ooh. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. Yeah.
And Dr. Segal actually said that in his article. It's kind of what he started. Drug cards, drug discount cards. If they make too many promises, you're probably going to want to run away from them.
The old clock on the wall has spun itself down.
Well, didn't anybody accost you this week on your way to Harold's? Or
they did, but I staved them off, and I'll tell everybody, you know, what I told them in our next podcast. But I staved them off with a bit of information, telling them that on our next podcast, we're going to explain the history of nitrous oxide.
Oh boy! Now there's something there. There's a subject I can really breathe in.
Yes, this
I can inhale that one.
It was invented a long time ago, and it kind of the barbed wire story kind of reminded me of the story because it was nobody believed that this was any good. And I'll tell the story about how nitrous oxide was invented and how the guy got to be a gazillionaire after people figured out that it was good.
Well, click, let's pull the plug on this one and, you know, crank the clock over to next week and try it again or
all right.
You know, 2 days from now or whatever.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. As we always say, we always appreciate you joining us. You could have been a lot of different places, but you are here joining us at the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast.
Don't forget to buy the book, Medicare for the Lazy Man 2020, on sale at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
And we would have an audiobook if...
yeah. If we could get those people. Now, your crack staff was going to look into the idea of maybe Sacrilege going to a different audiobook producer.
We are doing that. Something that we're highly considering because we're not moving anywhere with where we're at. So
I believe the Amazon organization is now specializing in toilet paper.
Yes, they absolutely are. They're shipping the stuff that makes them money, which is the toilet paper and flour.
Flour.
We're running out of flour now, too. So,
well, it's going to be pork products, they tell me, before long. Because there's a, South Dakota, there was a pork rendering plant that apparently had to be shut down because a bunch of Mexicans were infected or something. And I don't
know. Yeah. Well, South Dakota with pork plants, I know just exactly which one you're talking about because I'm from the Midwest. So,
yeah.
Again, thank you for taking your time with us, Doug, and thank you to the audience. You have just finished up about 33 and a half minutes listening to a podcast by the anti-insurance guy, Doug Jones, with Medicare for the LazyMan.com.
Bye-bye.